Welcome back, everybody, to a new episode of Kicking with Cure here on Full Press Radio, episode number 82. Happy to be back with you once again this week, our last episode in the month of June. July will be next week, 4th of July weekend coming up, and still so many great sports going on. We have so much to get to this week. Of course, the NBA playoffs still in full effect. Conference finals are mostly, they're all underway. One series close to being over. The other series, a best of five. We'll discuss that. And, of course, the aftermath of last week's Sixers loss in Game 7 and a couple coaching hires as well. We'll look ahead to the Stanley Cup Final, the Canadiens and the Lightning, beginning Monday night in Tampa Bay. And we're going to be joined by a special guest for that segment who covers the Canadiens. So we'll talk a little bit about Montreal's surprising run and why I think it looks to be similar to a team that had a run in baseball that's a powerhouse that usually is not looked at as an underdog. We're going to get into that. We'll do a little baseball. The sticky stuff enforcement began this week. Of course, get into it and give you my weekly update. And we will talk soccer. UEFA Euro 2020 in the knockout stages. We recorded a segment with a special guest from the Total Soccer Show. So if you were looking for some soccer talk this week, you got it. That's going to happen. And of course, we'll end with a little bit of look ahead to Wimbledon and a little bit of craziness in Omaha in the College World Series. Going to have to talk about that because while it's a fun final beginning Monday between Vanderbilt and Mississippi State, crazy road to how we got there. I want to remind you, you can tweet me on Twitter, @Rickinator555. It's @RICK, letter I, Nader, like a Terminator, 3 5s. Follow us on Twitter, @FullPressRadio, @FP_coverage. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You reach your podcast, just search Kicking with Keeler. All the episodes are there. And I want to hear from you. Tell me what you like, what you don't like. You can email me, rickjkeeler@gmail.com. I'm always happy to hear from you, hear your comments, your questions, anything you want to send that you'd want me to address on the show. Always happy to do that. Remember, you can download the Full Press Coverage app on your iOS or Android device. It's free, and you get all of our articles, podcasts, live shows. Everything is on there, so be sure to check that out. We would greatly appreciate it. So let's start with the conference finals, and let's start out west, a series that, in my opinion, is pretty much over. I know the Clippers have rallied from 0-2 deficits in each of the first two series against Dallas and against Utah. I don't think they could do it this time because you had a game like Saturday night where nobody's hitting anything in terms of shots. The Suns shot 36%, the Clippers 32.5%. The combined total on threes was 9 for 51. We saw a similar game in the Nets Bucks series in Game 3 where a person that likes old fashioned 80s, 90s basketball or scoring 100 points wasn't easy would like this game because of defense. I don't think it was much defense as more of team just couldn't hit water if it fell out of the boat. They got to give the Suns a lot of credit. Going on the road to Los Angeles, Clippers dominated Game 3 with a late run in the second half. And Phoenix did a really good job. DeAndre Ayton has been a factor on the boards, and the Clippers don't have an answer for him. In Game 4, Ayton had 19 points, 22 rebounds, 8-for-14 shooting in about 40 minutes. And he's proven why the Suns picked him the number one pick. I mean, you could hear about, should have taken Trae Young, should have taken Luka Doncic. They took the big man. And Ayton's proven to be a factor. When you got Devin Booker, who didn't make a single three-pointer and still put up 25 points. Chris Paul, back in the lineup in Game 3, starting to get used to everything again, even though he shot 6-for-22, had 18 points, 7 assists, and proved to be that veteran you want on the floor late in games. And it's great to see Chris Paul now one win away from finally getting a chance to play in the NBA Finals because he's earned it. He's one of the better point guards in the last 15, 20 years. And from all the near failures he's had, whether it's been injuries, players on the team getting injured, running in the Golden State, I mean, to finally maybe get that opportunity is going to be something special. Suns haven't been to the Finals since Charles Barkley in 1993. So we'll see if Phoenix can close the deal. But the problem for the Clippers is right now is late-game situations. You don't want to pin it all on Paul George because he's played really well without Kawhi Leonard. 23 points, 16 boards, 6 assists, but just 5-for-20 from the floor last night. And what hit the Clippers the most, it's not deciding the game last night, but missing those two free throws late when you're down 3. I know you may be trying to make one, then miss the second. It didn't work. And then Game 2, which is, I think, the deciding game of the series. Clippers are up one. Paul George is going to the line, misses both free throws. Suns then get an opportunity at the end, and of course the famous value play, which is a really smart play drawn up by Monty Williams. That's why he's the coach of the year, and I think Thibodeau should have been one of the Cavs coach of the year. I know Thibodeau won the award, and I agree with it, but Monty Williams has had such a great impact on the Phoenix Suns. Dials up a fantastic play. Booker sets a great screen, allows Ayton to get freely to the hoop, and the rest is history. That was a fun game to watch in Game 2. But Paul George kind of underwhelmed that situation. We've seen Zubac play better for the Clippers in the paint. He had a double-double on Saturday night. Reggie Jackson's played well with 20 points. But when the Clippers can't shoot the ball that well, and again, about 32.5%, you're not going to win these games. And you wonder what this team would be with Kawhi Leonard. Could they have pushed Phoenix to maybe 7 games? And again, you can't rule them out. But the electric atmosphere that will be in Phoenix Monday night for Game 5, I don't know how the Clippers survive. And you give the Suns credit. I've said, though, on this show, I wonder what their run would have been like if Anthony Davis was healthy for the Lakers and the Suns were down 2-1 after Game 3 in LA. Since then, they have won 13 of their last 14 games. So it just begs that question. Actually, not 13-14. We're gonna do the quick math here a little bit because we kind of ten of the last 11. They won 10 of the last 11. It begs the question: well, what happened? Again, that's a what if. It's the same thing like what if Kawhi was healthy. We just play these hypotheticals out. I'm not trying to underwhelm the Suns' run by any means, but it's kind of like when you look at the East. What would have happened if Brooklyn had 3 superstars instead of essentially 1.5 with James Harden playing on a bum hamstring? Don't know. But Phoenix leads that series. Again, they'll see if they close out on a Monday. The series that continues tonight in Atlanta. Bucks and the Hawks tied at a game apiece. Milwaukee did what they were supposed to do in Game 2. They kicked the living stuffing out of Atlanta. But the Hawks have proven why they're in the conference final. And there's so much pressure on Milwaukee to actually do great things in this series. I don't think there's much pressure on Atlanta, because think about the run the Hawks are on. They have won 9 games in these playoffs. 6 are on the road, including the Game 7 win in Philly, which we're going to talk about. Trae Young was awesome in Game 1, 48 points, 7 rebounds, 11 assists, doing what he had to do. And then you look at Friday night, the Bucks won by 34. This game was never close. And I think the key of this game, Trae Young was 1-for-8 from 3, and the Hawks were held at 9-for-36 from beyond the arc. Atlanta needs not just Young to put up points, but we only have 3 assists and he had 9 turnovers in this game. You got to block off those passing lanes for Trae Young. You kind of have to force him to be a shooter and get him frustrated when he's not making shots. Kind of like what happened before Nate McMillan took over as coach. But Milwaukee had a well-balanced attack. Chris Middleton played a lot better than he did in Game 1. 15 points on 13 shots. Giannis with 25. Jrue Holiday with 22. And if those 3 put up consistent numbers, it's tough to see Milwaukee losing this series, because we saw it against Brooklyn. You can win games when it's just Giannis, Holiday, Milton. They don't get much from their bench. I mean, Brook Lopez is a starter at 16, but their bench scoring really didn't do that much against Brooklyn. And look at their bench in general. I mean, you don't really aren't scared of many players on their bench. Maybe Conton can give you a couple of threes. Bobby Portis can give you some good minutes, but I mean, Forbes is okay. Nothing really scares you. And again, I do think the Bucks are overrated at times. But this is the easiest path for Giannis to get to a championship. I would probably make Phoenix the favorite over Milwaukee. I think Atlanta, though, does have a shot at winning the series. I still do. The problem for the Hawks, though, I mean, yes, you've won 6 of the 10 road games that you've played. But keep this in mind as well. They've lost a lot of home games. They lost Game 6 at home against Philadelphia. Lost Game 3 at home. And overall, they are 3-2 at home. If Atlanta wants to win this series, they've got home court. They've got to win all 3 home games. You can't rely on going to Milwaukee in Game 7 duplicating it again. I know you have probably the guy who's turned into a star, budding star. I'm not going to say superstar, because I think there's levels to superstar. But win your home games. You got the home court. Best 3 out of 5, and you have 3 home games. Got to win your games at home. still a fantastic run for Atlanta. I just think when we're talking next week and we're looking at the NBA Finals, I think it should be the Bucks and the Suns. I think it should be a fun matchup if that's the case, too. Outside of the on-court games, one more on-court topic, of course, is the surprising loss by Philadelphia. And talk about a team that had the roadmap cleared for them. All Philly had to do to get home court in the Eastern Conference Final and potentially in the NBA Finals was beat Atlanta in Game 7. They couldn't do it. And the problem, of course, has been well documented this week. What is Ben Simmons' future in Philadelphia? Ben Simmons took 4 shots in Game 7, really didn't become aggressive with his shot throughout the latter portion of the series. He's not been a jump shooter in his career. He's now having trouble attacking the basket and making his own shot. He's a great passer. But I've thought about this all week. Was Ben Simmons really that great of a shooter in college at LSU? Because I don't remember that. He was great at attacking the basket. And if you just allow him to do what he does, you're fine. The problem is Philly can't really allow him to do that, especially with a guy like Joel Embiid. You need kind of that guy to both score and take the pressure off of Embiid, where you're a threat to score rather than just, I'm going to dump the ball off. And when Doc Rivers said on Sunday night, I'm not sure he's a championship caliber point guard, the comments by Doc alone, and Doc Rivers has his own question answer because this is another collapse by Doc Rivers' coach team. You have to be able, like the writing's on the wall, Ben Simmons out of Philadelphia, because you can't bring him back in a sports town like Philly and people aren't going to really forgive him until the championship is won. And that's a lot of pressure on a guy like Ben Simmons. He's got a big contract. I think it's over $140 million owed on his deal. I don't really know who can take that on. I've seen someone like Brian Scott Brady mention Miami, where Ben Simmons would learn under Eric Spoelstra and Pat Riley. That might be a good change of scenery for him. I mean, could you make a deal with Portland to get either McCollum or Lillard or something like that? I don't think you can. There are teams out there that could use Ben Simmons. I don't think he's a washed-up player by any means. He's a talented player for what he is. The question is that all he's going to be, or is there still room for development? But you can make the case he's the reason they lost the series, because Embiid did everything he could with a partially torn meniscus. And they got good contributions all series from Seth Curry and Tobias Harris. I mean, is it time to get rid of Simmons and let Maxey be the point guard in Philly? Because Maxey's got a bright future there. They've got Thibault. They've got Milton. They've got good guard play. We're only going to find out. But I don't really know how this franchise, considering I think they've lost faith in Ben Simmons, can bring him back next year and be fully confident in it. It's a tough decision. The other big coaching moves this week, Jason Kidd gets the Dallas Mavericks job. Kidd's had a really up-and-down coaching career with Brooklyn and Milwaukee, but the one thing I think Kidd's done a good job with is player development, especially with your stars. I mean, look at the job he did with Giannis in Milwaukee. Now you give Luka Doncic, Jason Kidd, one of the all-time great point guards. This is strictly a hire, I think, to help Luka, because I don't really know if Jason Kidd's a coaching upgrade over Rick Carlisle, who now goes back to Indiana. I think he could do a good job at the Pacers. But you brought him in for Kidd, and the same thing with Portland, who looks like they're going to bring in Chauncey Billups. Now, I would have hired Becky Hammon. Billups, who's an assistant on the Clippers staff, though, probably another hire catered toward Damian Lillard. And that's okay. That's the NBA. You're catering your coaching hires to your superstar players to keep them happy and want them to stay. And to bring in a guy like Billups, who's an NBA champion, really good point guard, has a good knowledge of the game. Will it work? I'm not sure. He's never been a head coach before. But I think it's got a shot. To me, what I was looking forward to in this coaching cycle, I want to see Becky Hammon get hired. I think she's got the resume for it, working under Greg Popovich. Great WNBA player. Great with, we saw her win Summer League with the Spurs. She's kind of done a little bit of everything. I think she's paid her dues. I think it's kind of, if there was a trailblazer to be the first female coach in the NBA, it's time it's her. It's got to be. The other hire this week, the Celtics bringing in Brooklyn assistant Ime Udoka. I think that's a good hire, especially because you hear Udoka has good rapport with guys like Tatum and Brown. And that's the guys, again, Boston's going to build around those two guys. And Udoka has coached these guys before, I think, with Team USA in some way. So you're bringing a guy I think that Brad Stevens likes. Brad Stevens, of course, now the president there. I don't see any negative reasons for the Udoka hire. It's not flashy. It's not, oh my gosh, he's the next coach of the Celtics. But it's something to at least say, you know what, I think they did the right thing. There's still other openings out there. I think Orlando's still open as a coaching vacancy. Washington's still open. So there's still coaching hires to be made. I mean, let's throw this out there. Milwaukee lost the conference final to Atlanta. Do you get rid of Budenholzer? I don't think so. I think Budenholzer kept his job at being Brooklyn. If they had lost that series to Brooklyn, especially the way they looked like they were in a fold in Game 7, I don't see how you brought him back. But we'll find out next week with the NBA Finals. This is finally with the lottery. The Pistons get the number one pick. And I was kind of talking this with people I know. It was like when you saw that the final four teams that were in the running for the number one pick, I said, this is the kind of year that the Pistons would get the number one pick. And we all remember kind of the Pistons picking Darko Milicic with the second pick in the LeBron Carmelo Wade draft. Maybe this is their like second chance at a do-over. We'll see if they take Cade Cunningham from Oklahoma State. But the Pistons pick first. The Rockets pick second. Cavs pick third. Toronto picks fourth. Orlando picks fifth. And the Magic were really terrible. They tried to tank in the second half with some of the trades they made, especially getting rid of Aaron Gordon. And it doesn't pay out for them. Thunder picks sixth. Golden State gets the seventh pick. So we'll see what they do with that. Orlando has the eighth pick as well. Kings are ninth. Pelicans are 10th. Hornets are 11th. Spurs are 12th. Pacers 13th. Golden State 14th. And then Washington is 15th. So that's your look at the lottery. And to me, I think the Pistons are in a good position. I mean, if Cunningham's the pick, you got those two G League players, the top five of the draft. I think it should be interesting. I like Jalen Suggs, whoever gets him in the top five. But we'll talk about the NBA draft more when it happens. Roster got picked for Team USA. We're going to do more. I think we're going to try to do it more of an Olympics geared show in a few weeks. I've been watching, like I said last week, a lot of the trials with the gymnastics and swimming and the track and field. And we'll try to do it an Olympics themed show in a couple weeks because I think it's been worth doing. So we'll take our first break. We'll come back and we'll get into baseball, the sticky substance enforcement. Look ahead to some of the big games this week, some teams that might be in trouble as well. We get into July. We're starting to get about a month away from the trade deadline, so a lot of things can change. You're listening to Kicking with Keeler here on Full Press Radio. We will be right back after this. Back for segment two here on Kicking with Keeler on Full Press Radio. We're going to get into baseball in a second, but I want to remind you, of course, you can check out our live radio lineup every weekday on Full Press coverage. We've got FBC Radio Live with Ian Glendon and Mike DeBate every morning. So they get you set for the day's action, look back at the week, the day that was. We have College Credit Hour with Memphis Spence in the midday, and then later in the afternoon, Dylan and Ross, they save sports. They save it a lot, mostly all the time, but it's in the afternoon during the week. But three really good shows, and we have podcasts for different leagues, different teams. And if you see something we don't have, go to fullpresscoverage.com/contribute. Fill out an application. We'd love for you to be a part of our team. So be sure to check that out today. Let's get into baseball. The Sticky Substance Enforcement Police out this week. And it's been really weird at certain points. One of the things that really baffled my mind is you had, in Citi Field this week, you had Tyler Megel for the Mets make his Major League debut. Pitches a really good game. Comes out of the game in the fifth inning. Gets a standing ovation. As he's getting the standing ovation, the umps are checking his hat, checking the glove, checking the belt for any foreign substance. Not a great thing for Megel, especially that's a moment he's going to remember forever. You kind of have to have, if you're baseball, an idea of how that actually works. And whether that, I've seen that idea thrown out there, especially on the radio this week. What if each team had a compliance officer in which you can have that guy check in the dugout as opposed to having the umpire check it on the field once or twice a an outing. It's an idea I think that could work because you had certain instances where players are not happy, like i.e. Sergio Romo dropping his pants at the A's Rangers game this week. That was pretty funny, but I think the bad move by Romo. And a lot of people have also picked on Max Scherzer this week. There was the incident in the Nats-Philly series, as Kyle Schwarber keeps hitting home runs for the Nationals, about Scherzer was checked, like every pitcher was, first inning. Gets checked, I believe, again in the third inning. And then Joe Girardi notices Scherzer keeps going to his hair, because that's the only place where you can get the sweat from, to kind of combine with the rosin, because now you can't use the sunscreen, remember that. So Girardi says, now you got to go check him. So the umpire goes to check him. Scherzer said, what do you mean? You just checked me twice already. And Girardi gets in a fight, with chatting match with Nats hitting coach Kevin Long, gets in a shouting match with Scherzer. Girardi gets thrown out. And to me, this is a bad precedent set by Girardi here, because any manager could use that for gamesmanship. The starting pitcher is on a groove, pitching well, and getting in that rhythm. You can now just have the umpire check him, and there's no consequence if you're wrong. And that's what baseball has to fix. If you're going to keep doing these checks, and so far nobody's been caught, which is great, but I think also it's not surprising. Do you think any pitcher would be that stupid to get caught now? Yes, it's only a 10-game suspension with pay. You're missing only two starts if you're starting, one start if you're, maybe two if you're a starting pitcher, but you do you want that stain on your career that way? I don't think you do. But there's got to be a consequence that, let's say Girardi's wrong. You get thrown out of the game. Or there's a runner now put on first base. Or another idea I saw, that when your team's up at bat, you automatically start with one out. There's got to be, or you lose a challenge. If you're going to play these gamesmanship rules, and I can see managers that don't like each other doing it, you got to be able to stop the gamesmanship aspect of this. This is not what it was designed for. It was designed to stop the foreign substances in the game, and it's just baseball shooting themselves in the foot. And I know Rob Manfred said everything's going right. It's not. Because you should be talking about awesome things in sports this week, and awesome things in the sport. You should be talking about Wander Franco making his debut for the Rays this week, the top prospect in all of baseball. We should be talking about Shohei Ohtani going to the home run derby. Talking about the home run battle between Fernando Tatis Jr. and Vlad Guerrero Jr. And Kyle Schwarber, as I mentioned, in the running. And he's been crushing the ball. There are so many things we should be talking about and leading with in baseball. And it's constantly the sticky stuff problem he's bringing up. Maybe baseball likes it. Maybe they like that we're actually leading with it and actually talking about it as either a lead block on a sports show or a second block on a sports show. But is it worth it? I don't think it is. Yes, any publicity is good publicity. It's the popular line. I don't think really baseball needs it, nor should they want it, if that makes any sense. Speaking of the home run derby, it's starting to come into fruition in terms of who will be a Coors Field for the All-Star game and for the derby itself. Pete Alonso is going to try to defend his title. Shohei Ohtani, of course, will be there, and that'll be fun. Great story, the Trey Mancini, the Orioles first baseman, won his battle with cancer. He's going to be in the home run derby. I think that's really cool and definitely be a fan favorite when they get to Coors Field in a couple weeks. Remember, home run derby is July 12th, so we're actually not that far away. I know as we do the show, they are picking, or going to announce who are the finalists each position, and then you vote on those finalists to who makes the All-Star team next week. Arizona Diamondbacks as well finally got off the schneid. They won their first road game in the last 25 games. But the other thing was no-hitters this week. The Cubs throwing a combined no-hitter against the Dodgers. Again, are combined no-hitters a big thing? I would say no. I think it's great. I think it's cool. But it's not the same cachet as a, or same pizzazz as a individual no-hitter. Especially when Davies walked like five guys, but Tapera and Chafin and Kimbrel did a good job closing it down. Dodgers have been struggling. I had a rough week in San Diego, rough start to week in Chicago, though Cody Bellinger hitting a walk-off home run. It's kind of helped stabilize things for the Dodgers a little bit in a competitive National League West. So let's take a look at the standings while we're here. This is as before games begin on Sunday, because as you're listening to this, I'm sure games have started already. Tampa Bay with a half-game lead on the Red Sox. Rays were able to bounce back against Boston this week. They've won four in a row. Red Sox have a 5.5-game lead on the Yankees. Yankees are six back in the East, and we've seen it again this week. Alex Cora is 10 times the manager Aaron Boone is. Red Sox have won five straight against the Yankees. And these games haven't exactly been blowouts either, but the Yankees get thrown out on the bases. They get backed up. They're not hitting home runs. They're not scoring runs. And it's an issue. Because every time you think the Yankees have gone two steps forward, they take two steps back. And when you can't beat Tampa and you can't beat Boston, how do you expect to win the division and how do you expect to go to the playoffs? You don't. And now you lost Zach Britton again to an injury, which was going to hurt their bullpen. They have Gerrit Cole on the mound as we speak, so this is a big... Yankees have to win this game. They cannot afford to drop the first six games of the season against Boston, because guess who they play seven times coming out of the break? Boston. And they play Tampa. So this is the next month, and it's going to be really big for the Yankees. Blue Jays are 6.5 games back. We talked about Vlad Jr. Trying to get themselves back in the mix in Baltimore. Of course, bringing up the rear in the AL East. In the Central, White Sox, 2-game lead on the Indians. And then the rest of the division, well, it's terrible. Royals have lost 4 straight. Tigers and Twins round out that division. The Astros had their 11-game win streak snapped Saturday by the Tigers, but they still have a 3-game lead on the A's, who have lost the first 2 games in their series against the Giants. Giants winning that Bay Area battle there. Seattle's playing really well. They've won 8 of their last 10. They're 3 games over 500. They are 8 back in the division, but the Mariners have a half game worse than the Yankees. Shows you where Seattle is, and I think their young players are starting to really contribute. Angels are 11.5 back. They've lost 5 straight. Looking like they're going to be a seller again, and Texas in last in that division. Now to the National League and the NL East, where we all thought, especially myself, that this division would be very competitive the entire season. Oh, it's competitive, but for the wrong reasons. The Mets are the only team over 500, and you got to give the Mets credit. They're 24-10 at home. They're 40-32 on the year. Jacob DeGrom's going to end June with a .69 ERA. And they've done it with a lot of their guys out, but they've got Jeff McNeil back. They've got Michael Conforto back. Their starting rotation did lose Marcus Stroman, but he is coming back. Taiwan Walker's been great for them. And they're going to likely have their whole opening day lineup back by the break. Brandon Nimmo's on a rehab assignment. J.D. Davis close to a rehab assignment. So things starting to look up for the Mets, and they've kind of built a good separation ground here. The Nationals are 5 games back. We talked about Kyle Schwarber and his power surge, but the Nats are starting to look like at least they'll be around to the point where I'm not sure if Max Scherzer is actually going to be available at the deadline. And I saw an article this week. Scott Boras said that Scherzer would waive his no trade, depending on the team, without an extension. So you don't have to really trade for Scherzer and sign up at the same time. It is big news. I just don't think Scherzer's getting dealt. Braves, 6 games back. Mike Soroka's out for the year. They really had no consistency with their starting pitching. A lot of injuries for this team. I think Atlanta, you can make the case, outside of Minnesota and a couple other teams, one of the more disappointing teams in baseball this season. Phillies are there as well. They've had a terrible week. I mean, you go back to Thursday where they led 5-0, 9-5, and 12-11 against the Nationals. Couldn't hold either lead. There is so much pressure on Joe Girardi right now. It's not even funny. Philly is 14-25 away from home as well. I mean, the team with Harper and Realmuto and Hoskins and all that talent to be that bad at home or that bad on the road. Pressure on Girardi to get it done. They've already fired Klentak last year. New GM. Can't blame him. So Girardi might be next. Marlins, of course, are also in last, but only 2 behind the Phillies for 4th place. In the Central, Milwaukee, 2-game lead on the Cubs. Brewers have won 4 in a row. They played Colorado this weekend. Rockies are off on the road, so no shock there. Reds are starting to play better. They're 5 games back, a game over 500. Cardinals have slipped, lost 7 of their last 10, but again, no Jack Flaherty, no Miles Michaelis. Their rotation's not been any good, so no surprise why they're in 4th place, and the Pirates are in last. And in the West, Giants, 4.5 game lead on the Dodgers. Giants have won 5 straight. Really good West Coast trip for them with the Angels and the A's. At the Angels hosting the A's, I should say. Dodgers, 4.5 back. Padres are 5.5 back. And then the Rockies, who are terrible. You mentioned Arizona actually won a road game for the first time, which is crazy how Arizona just had a 24-game road losing streak. And their road record is 4 wins better than Colorado. The wonders of baseball in 2020, I will just say that much. So here's the schedule of what you're looking at this week. Again, we're heading into July. The sad thing is, I was going to mention with the Mets, Luis Rojas, their manager, said Jacob DeGrom is going to pitch Thursday, so you don't get DeGrom versus Cole in the Bronx, which I think every baseball fan wanted. So maybe pray for rain and pray they have a change of heart, but They want Tegron to pitch three times before the break, and the only way that happens is if he doesn't pitch the Yankee series. So this week, some series to watch. You have Angels-Yankees, Shohei Ohtani's first visit to the Bronx. So that should be a fun matchup from an entertainment perspective. Mets and Nats play a makeup game on Monday. You have also this week, Cubs at Brewers, big matchup in the National League Central in Milwaukee. Of course, that's always been a de facto home road series for the Cubs. But the Brewers are playing well, as I mentioned earlier. And Giants at Dodgers, again, big series for the Dodgers because the Giants, potentially, if things go right for them today, could play L.A. with a 5.5-game lead. And again, the Dodgers have talent, but if the Giants were to win this series here, it just adds to that separation. Looking ahead to the weekend matchups, also this week, well, I'll give you Tuesday because some of these series are earlier in the week. Tampa Bay and Washington for three, I think is going to be fun. Mets at the Braves. And I think that was for the early portion series. So let's go to July and let's look ahead to the 4th of July weekend. I mentioned Mets-Yankees, Dodgers at Nationals. Rays and Blue Jays, I think is going to be a fun series in Buffalo. Nolan Arenado makes his return to Colorado. The Cardinals play the Rockies. And Red Sox at A's, that's a good one. Two teams right up there in the mix in their respective divisions. We saw Oakland play well at Fenway earlier this year, so now Boston heads out west. So we'll see how it shakes out. Next week, we're going to get into the what to expect going to the All-Star rosters. Remember, that those will be announced on 4th of July, so that'll probably be another week or two before we get to discuss that. There was the MLB Draft Combine this week, so as a prospect nerd like I am, I enjoyed watching that. MLB draft coming up in a couple of weeks, and go to pincheyeprospects.com. We're going to talk about all the MLB draft stuff from Yankee perspective as well as their strong farm system. This week we're going to be recording with Nathan Rohde from Prep Baseball Report to get a look at the high school players in the draft. That'll be on Thursday in addition to our regular show. So very quickly, let's get into hockey. Stanley Cup final is set. Montreal Canadiens, Tampa Bay Lightning on Monday. Canadiens, very impressive series win over Vegas in six. Carey Price has been great in net. They've had a good mix of youth and veterans on the team that have been contributing in a big way. Cole Caulfield, somebody you definitely want to watch in this Stanley Cup final. The last one, by the way, on NBC before ESPN and Turner pick up that package. So I think it's going to be a fun series. Lightning beat the Islanders in Game 7, 1-0. Varlamov plays so well for the Islanders in net. The problem New York had, just couldn't get the goals when they needed them. They have talent on that team with Barzal, and Beauvillier was big in the series, but Vasilevskiy stopped every shot he needed to. And he's also proven, I think, when the Lightning, despite with all the offense they had with Kucherov, and who's banged up but played in Game 7, Stamkos and Point and Killorn and all these guys, you forget they have a really great goaltender. So we want to bring you the best hockey insight we can because I admittedly am not the biggest hockey fan, and I don't have as much knowledge in the game, so I wanted to bring in somebody to help me talk about it. So this week, I was joined by Jared Book. He is the deputy managing editor over at Habs Eyes on the Prize, which is the Canadian side of SB Nation. We get into Montreal, the surprise they are, the breakthrough playoffs this has been for Carey Price as he finally gets to play in a cup final, the X factors in the series, and so much more. So stay tuned for my conversation with Jared Book, and we will come back after that segment and do some soccer. So some Stanley Cup analysis coming up here on Kicking with Keeler after this short break. Tonight, game one between the reigning Stanley Cup champion, the Tampa Bay Lightning, and the surprise of this Stanley Cup tournament, the Montreal Canadiens, the most iconic, one of the more iconic franchises in the NHL, back in the Stanley Cup final. And joining me to talk about this series and the Canadiens' surprise run is the deputy managing editor for Habs Eyes on the Prize, Jared Book is here. Jared, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing pretty good. So I had to start with this. If I told you when this playoff started that Montreal would be down 3-1 in their first round series, yet would still be in the Stanley Cup final, what would your reaction have been?
If you would have told me when they were down 3-1 that they would be in the Stanley Cup final, I think I'd have even more surprised reaction because the thing about this Canadiens team is that there was always the chance that they can put it all together. And when they won the first game against Toronto, it was like, okay, they have a chance now. And then they go and lose the next three. scoring two goals total in those games. And then it's like, okay, well, the problems that this team had are still obviously here. So, yeah, I think it was probably more surprising when they were down 3-1 than if you would have told me that at the beginning, because just the way they lost those three games to go down in that first series, it just didn't, you know, it didn't look like anybody was going to keep their jobs or anything, because it was just, they looked as helpless as they did for most or part of the regular season. So it's definitely surprising, but as the series went on, as the playoffs went on, it started to get less surprising. And now it's just, this is, I guess, who they are. So it's a lot of fun to see this team kind of play. They're literally, we talk about peaking at the right time. They are literally peaking at the right time. And that's what's happening right now.
So I should say, what caused this team to click again? But I probably should go back to the season. What caused this team to click after it got off to a shaky start? Claude Julien gets removed. They bring in Dominique Duchamp, who hasn't even been coaching in the semifinal because of COVID. But what kind of impact has their new coach had?
Well, you saw signs of life. Like, every time, like, I see it as, like, you always thought they were going to turn the corner. And then they just didn't. The corner got a little bit longer and a little bit longer, a little bit farther away. And you always saw that little light at the end of the tunnel. You're like, okay, they're starting to show things, but they never put it together. And I think a major part of why people look at this Canadiens team as not very good is because of their last 25 games of the season were played within 43 days. So that's like less than a game less than every 2 days. It was an insane schedule, and other teams in the NHL have had that schedule due to COVID outbreaks, you know, throughout their season. But the difference is that those schedules affected every team in the division, whereas Montreal, in those 43 days, played 25 games. The next closest team only played 20 games. So they had several games, if not most of their games, where the other team was literally just sitting and waiting for them to finish a game, come into town, and play them. So you never really got to see what this team was capable of, because their schedule just didn't even allow them to practice. And you mentioned the new coach. You know, how are you going to implement a system and fix mistakes without a practice? And that was one of the things that struggled. And then they had a week off before the playoffs started. They had more practices, full practices, in that week than they did the entire season. So it's a lot of things that you know went against them to make them look worse than they were. And you know, having the break and getting things together finally allowed them to work out the kinks.
I think the most impressive part of that schedule being different is because, from what I remember, the North Division in Canada had to play back to backs in the playoffs, and that's something you don't see. Really, the only sport you see that in is baseball. So the fact that this team has been this good and played back-to-backs in both their first and second round series, they've kind of had a more, it's tough to say this, but a more tougher road than the Golden Knights did, or the two teams that were in the other semifinal.
Yeah. I mean, they had to catch up because they started so much later. They started a couple days later. So they were constantly playing catch up with their schedule. And yeah, you know, the funny thing is that the real, you know, the back-to-back that really made them struggle was in games 3 and 4 in the Toronto series. And that was when, you know, things were at their lowest, or at least they seemed to be at their lowest. And then they come back after another day off and started their run. So, yeah, it was definitely a kink in the schedule. But when you're talking about a playoff series, at least it's the same for both teams to a certain extent. And now, you know, ironically, in the Stanley Cup final, they're going to have a break of two games next weekend, so between games four and five. So it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen. But yeah, the schedule was definitely a factor because it wasn't even. It wasn't like every team was playing, you know, 23, 24, 25 games. If you have one team at 25 games, the closest team in the division was 20 games. Some teams only played 19 in that span. So it was definitely a disadvantage. Then you're talking about putting a system in. Yeah, they just seemed like players said after they were down 3-1, is like, we can't end like this. We have more to give. And they just kind of flicked the switch, and the result is where they are right now.
this is the Canadiens team that a lot of people are going to get introduced to in terms of there are some veterans on the team that people would know, but also like Shea Weber, Corey Perry. But there's a lot of youth on this team. So talk about the job that Mark Bergevin has done outside of wearing a cool red suit and acting crazy after the semifinal against Vegas. But how good of a job has he done being the finishing second in the GM of the year and building both a roster of veterans and impactful young players?
Yeah, that's the real thing is that, you know, 3 years ago he said he was going to do a reset. And not a rebuild, but just a reset. And part of that was trading Max Pacioretty to Vegas. In that trade, he got Nick Suzuki, who is their second top scorer in and they're on their top offensive line in this playoffs. You know, part of that was drafting in 2018 Jesperi Kotkaniemi third overall, ahead of some players who were expected to go ahead of him. And, you know, he's been a solid third line center, a rock on that line that can provide offense as well. And, you know, he has 9 goals before turning 21, which ties him with Wayne Gretzky and Sidney Crosby. So, you know, those are pretty good names to be a part of when you're not even 21 years old. He's in his third season. He's not even 21 years old yet. He only turns 21 in July. And, you know, then the big name is Cole Caulfield. And that's a name where, you know, get to know that name because he's going to, you know, be the face of American hockey. I think, you know, along with guys like Austin Matthews and, you know, Patrick Kane is a little bit older, obviously, but, you know, he's a guy who was playing NCAA hockey 2 months ago. And now he's third on the team in scoring, second team in goal scoring. And he's just, I don't think anybody, he's played more playoff games than he had regular season games in the NHL this year. So he's really been the revelation. You know, Suzuki and Kotkaniemi kind of did it last year in the bubble against Pittsburgh, against Philadelphia. But Cole Caulfield is one of the guys who's really making a big difference for this team.
Also, it's been kind of not the coming out party, but kind of the culmination for Carey Price. I know to me, Price has been, I mean, here in New York, we look at Henrik Lundqvist and one of the better goalies to not win a Stanley Cup. Carey Price is right up there. And after really just that one playoffs where the Canadiens got to the conference final and lost to the Rangers, has this been a breakthrough for Carey Price in your mind?
Absolutely. You mentioned Lundqvist. You know, Henrik Lundqvist, Roberto Luongo, Carey Price are really like the three top goalies of this generation with Marc-Andre Fleury, you know, somewhere close to that. The difference between those three and Fleury is that they haven't had team success. You know, Luongo and Lundqvist lost in the Stanley Cup final. Up until this year, Price has not even gotten to this point. You know, you mentioned 2014 against the Rangers. He was injured in game one of that series. You know, so he didn't really play in that third round. You know, 2010, when they had that run, the Canadiens had that run against Washington and Pittsburgh, Price was the backup to Yaroslav Halak that year. So Price has really never been in this kind of this late in the season, and he really, you know, I mentioned the difference between game four and game five. After game four, the media asked Carey Price, are you frustrated that the team isn't scoring ahead of you? Because he wasn't playing bad at all. And he's like, no, I'm not. I believe in this team. They can score goals. You know, I see them in practice. They're talented. They're skilled. And since then, they're 11-2. So, you know, Carey Price has talked about a leader in this group. All the players talk about him as a leader. We rarely get to see Carey Price being a leader, but that wasn't to the media that he was saying that. He was saying that to the players, and that really has been the turnaround. But his play has been outstanding as well. You know, 12-5 record, 202 goals against average, 934 save percentage. And the crazy thing is that he's not being asked to steal games, other than maybe game three against Vegas. He's just made the biggest saves, the greatest saves at the perfect time. You know, one goal games, two, you know, close games, tied games. And he has had a definite career defining performance in this playoffs, absolutely.
So let's get to the question I'm sure you've thought about since late Friday night. How does this Canadian team beat the reigning Stanley Cup champions?
Doing exactly what they've been doing. You know, it's kind of crazy because, you know, Tampa Bay might be the best team that they've played, but, you know, you could have said that about Vegas as well. And the key to this team is just getting getting key goals and playing their solid defensive structure. And it's not a trap, because they are aggressive in the neutral zone and the defensive zone, but they just have to play the way they've been playing, and they've been growing in confidence. And, you know, nobody thought that they'd be, you know, able to do what they did against Vegas, and they ended up doing that. Now they're going to face a Tampa team that's a little bit more like Toronto than maybe Vegas or Winnipeg were. But I think that they're up for it. I mean, nobody thought they'd get this far. Nobody thought they'd get through Vegas. Nobody probably thinks they're going to get through Tampa Bay. And part of me thinks that that's exactly the way they want it to be.
There's a good, to me, a good contrast in styles. You have both these teams allowed the same number of goals in this postseason, which is crazy. Both teams very good defensively. So the question I have for you, Jared, is there, what concerns you the most playing this Tampa team? Is it their offensive firepower, even with a banged up and probably compromised Nikita Kucherov?
Yeah, I think that's really the worrying part of this Tampa team is just their depth offensively. And, you know, you mentioned Toronto, you know, after John Tavares got hurt, they never really had that secondary scoring other than, you know, William Nylander. So they never really had to play a team. You know, Vegas is kind of similar in that they had the, you know, the Mark Stone, Patrick Reddy line, and then they have Riley Smith, Marchessault, and William Karlsson. And they shut both of those two lines down. So it's going to be similar to that. But yeah, I mean, Tampa is really good. You know, Braden Point and Kucherov and Stamkos, and there's so many guys that can just break open a game at any moment. And that's what Montreal has been really good at defending against. And Andrei Vasilevskiy is probably going to be the best goaltender they've played in this playoffs, with no disrespect to Robin Lehner or Marc-Andre Fleury. So yeah, I mean, Tampa Bay is a well-oiled machine. And if you play this series, you know, 10 times, Tampa Bay probably wins it more often. But they only get one shot at this, and the thing that Montreal has now is kind of, I don't want to say a desperation, but an urgency. You know, you mentioned Carey Price. They also have Shea Weber, who's at the, you know, the back nine of his career, and, you know, they had never made it this far. Shea Weber had never played a third round game before this year. Carey Price had never been to the final. So I think now is you're starting to see this team thinking, okay, we're here. It took us this long to get here. We might never get back here. And I think that there's that urgency that they can tap into that maybe Tampa Bay can't, you know, having won last year and pretty much the same team, and they're back again this year. So I don't think that swings the series necessarily, but when it gets to that point, it's definitely something that they have to tap into. But yeah, Tampa Bay is a very good team, and they won the Stanley Cup and last year, and now they have a chance to play in front of their fans and go for a second one. And I think that's going to be a tough challenge, but everything has seemingly been supposed to be a tough challenge for this Montreal team.
The goalie matchup to me here, Jared, is fascinating, because you've got Price, who's had a really great postseason, and you got Vasilevskiy. And I'm listening to PK Subban on ESPN after Game 7 against the Islanders, and him saying, well, Varlamov was the best player for the Islanders on the ice. But you have Vasilevskiy on the other side, who's very quietly stopping 94% of his shots. So I think, to me, the goaltender matchup in this series is so fascinating, because we talk about Tampa's firepower. It's kind of like Vasilevskiy's been one of the better goalies in the NHL and doesn't really get talked about like it.
Yeah, I think that that's an aspect of playing behind such a good team, is that he can be, you know, when Tampa Bay wins 1-0, like they did in Game 7 against the Islanders, the narrative isn't, oh, Vasilevskiy stole that game. It's like, no, the better team won, and they got a shorthanded goal, and that was the story. But, you know, Vasilevskiy is a great goaltender. He might, you know, if you asked me before the playoffs who the best goalie in the league was, I would probably lean Vasilevskiy, just because, you know, obviously Carey Price is showing what he can do, but in the regular season, he hasn't really shown that, especially this year. So, you know, it's definitely a factor. But you look at Vasilevskiy, the last three, you know, or four series clinchers that he had were all shutouts. And that's just a testament to just a goalie who is able to shut it down when you have a chance to close out a series. And that's what he's been doing. And yeah, I think that he doesn't get the respect that necessarily he deserves, because the team in front of him is so good. And we see that a lot with coaches and, you know, general managers. Like, you look at the coach of the year candidates and the GM of the year candidates. They're not necessarily the best GMs and the best coaches of the best teams. It's usually the most surprising, or, you know, things like that. And the Vezina kind of trends in that way too, where it's the best goalie on the, you know, most mediocre team for more often than not. And I think, you know, there's obviously exceptions to that, but I think that Vasilevsky is definitely a guy who, you know, deserves more recognition for this Tampa team being as good as they are, even with the defense and the forwards that they do have.
Give me an X factor for both teams in this series. Who do you think is going to be that under-the-radar player that people should keep an eye on?
I think for Tampa, Yanni Gourde is a guy who sticks out. He obviously had the shorthanded goal in Game 7. I think that, you know, guys like that, Alex Killorn, Anthony Cirelli, I think that if Tampa is going to do what Toronto, Winnipeg, and Vegas couldn't, they're going to need more than a couple of guys to score. And that's what I think that Tampa can do. They're positioned to do that well. So I think that, you know, if they focus on shutting down the top guys, the secondary guys are going to have to step up, and that's something that the other teams had struggles with. And for Montreal, I think I'm going to go with Josh Anderson. I'm going to change my answer. I'm going to go with Philip Deneau. And the reason I'm going to go with him is obviously he's talked about a lot for his defense, and he's been great defensively. But that line is also starting to create chances. You saw it in overtime of Game 6. That was their first point of the series, but they were starting to get chances. Brendan Gallagher is not a defensive player. He's an offensive player. He's there to score goals. And I think that line, they're so good at shutting down the opposition. If they can start getting some goals, that might be just enough to tip the balance in Montreal's favor.
So last question, Jared, and you and I have talked in the past, but from a baseball perspective, and I kind of, when you're talking, hearing you talk about the Canadiens, they're that franchise, I feel like, in hockey with all the Stanley Cup championships. You either love me or hate them. Is this Montreal version kind of like the team I came to mind is the 2016 Yankees, where people used to hate the Yankees, then they got this infusion of youth, and then people wanted them to win? Or is that in the hockey version of this Canadiens team, where you used to love or hate them, and now they're youthful and they're back in the final, first Canadian team in 10 years? That people want to root for them, even though they hated Montreal.
I think that's actually a pretty good, you know, comparison, because, you know, the teams in the Yankees in the 90s and you know, really their turnaround were, you know, we're gonna outspend and things like that. But really, the core four was the base of that team. Without them, you know, well, free agents want to come there and things like that. And with the Montreal team, it's, you know, they have kind of the old guard in that Weber and Price are still around. They've been around for a while, Gallagher. And then they're starting to fill in with a new generation of players. And I think that is, a good comparison. But, you know, maybe it's actually, this is like the 96 Yankees, where you have the core four and Montreal has, you know, the Caulfields and Caulfield Suzuki's and Kotkaniemi's and those guys. And that's the guys who are bringing up the guys in the back, you know, the older guys, the Jim Leyritz and guys like that. So maybe it's more of the mid to late 90 Yankees than it is the 2001. But yeah, it's that, you know, the Canadiens and the Yankees are definitely 100% the two most similar franchises, I think, not only because of their winning, but just because they have rivalries that are close together geographically, that everyone else hates them. And I think that's definitely a good comparison. But yeah, it's definitely a similar vibe around this Canadiens team, because, you know, the Yankees, when they started to contend again, were kind of the surprising underdog at times. And that's kind of weird to say. And that's, you know, same thing about the Canadiens. You know, when this footnote happens, it's going to be like, oh, of course the Canadiens won again. But I think the story is a little bit different this time around.
Last question, looking at it from the process of playing hockey still in the pandemic, and especially in Canada, where you're watching these venues in America have full capacity, and understand watching a little bit of Game 6 against Vegas, it's only 3,500 now. Outside, it's not, because it's craziness and celebrating after the conference final. Is there any talk of them expanding capacity for the final at all? And do you think that could play a factor playing a Stanley Cup final in a limited capacity crowd, or is it just the same?
I think it still gives them some advantage. The big question last series was how would they react playing in a full arena for the first time? Because obviously coming out of Canada, they didn't have that. You know, they had the most fans with at that point, 2,500. So the question was, how would they react to playing in Vegas? And the answer was they went 2-1 in Vegas. So it obviously wasn't that much of a factor. But I do, you know, they've only lost one game at home since they started having fans in the arena. And I think that it is a factor, even if it is reduced capacity. I would be surprised if it did not go up. I think that you'll see, you know, maybe 5,000, maybe a little bit higher. There are obviously some public health things to look at and things like that, but I would be surprised if it didn't go up a little bit, but I don't think you'll see anywhere close to half or anything like that. Just because if they make the exception for the Canadians, they'll have to make other exceptions, and they've been pretty steady on that they don't want to be, an exception. So, I would be surprised if it didn't go up, but right now it's still stated to be 3,500. That's how the Canadians are going forward for games 3 and 4. But, you know, if the numbers trend in the right direction, I think you might see a little bit more fans.
Well, tell listeners out there, Jared, about Eyes on the Prize. What are you doing over there for the Stanley Cup final, and how they can follow you and the site on Twitter?
Yeah, so Habs Eyes on the Prize is we like to think of ourselves as the best place for all Canadians news throughout the organization. We have a lot of great people from all over the world. We have people in Europe, people in the States, people in Canada, all over. So we're great. We have a few people who are working for NHL teams right now as well. So a bit long history there. They could follow me at Jared Book on Twitter, and the website is at Habs, HABSEOTP as well, and HabsEyesOnThePrize.com is the website.
Should be a great final, last final on NBC, so it'll be even more interesting in itself. So be sure to check out Jared and the team's coverage at Habs, Eyes, and the Prize if you want the Canadians' perspective of this series. Jared, again, thanks for coming on. Good luck covering the final, and I'll talk again soon. It's been fun.
Thanks for having me.
Special thanks to Jared Book from Habs Eyes on the Prize for hopping on the show, doing a little Stanley Cup final with us. So we'll be talking about that as well next week, as by then it should be game 3. We'll likely record next week's episode. It'll be likely out on July 3rd. I'm trying not to have a show come out on July 4th. So July 3rd, Saturday, will be next week's show. Let's talk some soccer. UEFA Euro 2020 in full effect. The knockout stages in play. We kind of got a little bit into last week. But the group stages are over, and it's been a fun tournament so far. Two knockout games in the books. Denmark, who's been, I think, the big surprise this tournament. The feel-good story of this tournament with the sad thing that happened to the cardiac arrest that Christian Eriksen had on the field the first match against Finland. But Denmark has responded. They beat Russia to get to the knockout stage and then crushed Wales. Gareth Bale just did nothing in terms of goal scoring in this tournament, and Denmark was on the aggressive in this game. So Denmark won 4-0 in that match. They will play either the Netherlands or Czech Republic, which is going on as we speak in the second half. That is a fun matchup there. And Italy, who I thought was really one of the top teams in this group stage. We're going to get into it with our special guest. Italy hung on in extra time to beat Austria 2-1. Austria had the lead in the 65th minute, but an offsides took away Austria's goal. Probably, and it was the right call, but tough break for Austria, who was a severe underdog coming in. But Italy will wait the winner of the game later today, which you should watch on ABC. Great talent between Belgium and Portugal. Cristiano Ronaldo, of course, playing for Portugal. Belgium's got Lukaku, Kevin De Bruyne, and Eden Hazard. A lot of great talent on this Belgian side. But we're going to get into that match and break that down a little bit later. Monday, Croatia against Spain at noon on ESPN. Spain starting to wake up. They got through the group stage, luckily, with a win over Slovakia. Croatia, I know one of their players, Perisic, tested positive for COVID, so it'll be a tough match for them. And then France and Switzerland at 3 o'clock on ESPN. France, the reigning World Cup champions. And then Tuesday, England, Germany, noon ESPN from London. That'll be fun. And then Sweden against the Ukraine. Italy will await the winner, as I said, of Belgium and Portugal. That game will be Friday afternoon. Denmark awaits the winner of Netherlands, Czech Republic. That game is Saturday afternoon. So I think it's been a fun tournament. I love knockout stages. I love international tournaments because you get a chance at penalty kicks And that's something we get into as well coming up. So my guess for this week, I'm going to tell you a little bit about why I wanted to have this person on the show. My guest this week was Joseph Lowry. He is one of the hosts on the Total Soccer Show. Now, that used to be the Total Football Soccer Show. They rebranded their name, but I'm going to tell you why I wanted somebody from that show on. I am not the biggest soccer fan, the same way I am with hockey. But one of the shows I got into about, I think when the World Cup was in Rio, so let's say 2013, I want to learn the game, and I'm, the theme is always, all right, find a Premier League team and get into it. And I've thought about it, and I just haven't had the buzz to get into it. Because, again, I like either watching international soccer or Team USA play. It's really my two things. But I think what the Total Soccer Show does, if you're someone like me that is not the most knowledgeable soccer fan, they give you the information for both the diehard fan that understands the tactics and everything like that, and can enjoy the beauty of a nil-nil game, which I still can't. But also put it in a way that people understand it. Like, people like me can go, oh yeah, I get it. And I think it's just been, to me, I wanted to talk more Euro in this tournament on the show because it's the first big international event since COVID-19. And the next one's the Olympics next month. And this tournament, outside of the whole thing that happened with Ericsson, it's an unfortunate situation, is really the first test of how can an international tournament run. And so far it's gone pretty well. So coming up next, you will hear my conversation again with Joseph Lowry from the Total Soccer Show. We're actually going to talk soccer, and I hope you all enjoy it. We'll try to bring this back maybe when, maybe also in addition to the Euros, we talked that win that USA had over Mexico a couple weeks ago and how big that could be for them going into World Cup qualifying. The other big UEFA news this week, my pet peeve with soccer is when you get to these knockout stages in like the Champions League and you'd have a tie after two matches, but because one team had more road goals than the other, they would advance. Not the case now. Coming next year, there's a tie after two legs, which is what they call games. There will be extra time and penalty kicks. So, to me, I never liked a team advanced on road goals, but that's just me. So, Joseph Lowry from the Total Soccer Show coming up, and we will wrap it up with Wimbledon and craziness in Omaha at the College World Series. You're listening to Kicking with Keeler on Full Press Radio, where we're talking more Euro 2020 after this. Join me now here on Kicking with Keeler. Yes, we are talking soccer. UEFA Euro 2020 going on, and they are in the knockout stage as we record this. So to get the insight on what's going on in group play, look ahead to a crazy knockout round in what I think really the first international tournament since COVID, which I think is also interesting. You can hear him on the Total Soccer Show, which is my go-to show where I need to hear about soccer. Joseph Lowry is here. Joseph, how are you today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Always happy to talk some soccer. So before we get into the round of 16, the matchups to watch, just give me your insight on what has stood out to you so far and the tournament going off without a hitch. And like I said, I don't think it's gotten enough attention being the first big international tournament since the COVID shutdown before we get to the Olympics next month.
It has been impressive. And it's also been a different format for the Euros in terms of how this whole thing has been produced and hosted and how the event's actually gone down. So normally the Euros are held in a specific location or a generally very tight area. This year, that's not the case. With the tournament being pushed back from 2020 to 2021, we're still calling it Euro 2020, apparently, because that's the branding that they've kept from last year to this year. But it's being held in different cities all over Europe. So some teams have had a little bit of a home field advantage. They've been playing games in a lot of different countries. But that's a different thing, and I think it's important that that's happened to not put so much strain on any particular area as we're still in the middle of this pandemic. So, yeah, it's extremely impressive that this tournament has been able to go on, and obviously we're hopeful, we're going to continue to be hopeful that things go smoothly, health-wise, most importantly. Yeah. In terms of takeaways from the group stage so far, we've seen some really, really strong teams, and we've seen some pretty consistent patterns in terms of how games have been played. So one of my biggest takeaways is there's been a lot of teams having a ton of the ball and passing a lot, and a lot of teams sitting back and defending over and over again. The first game of this tournament was Italy against Turkey. And Italy are this possession juggernaut kind of team. They're this attacking team. And Turkey very much sat deep and defended. And that pattern has happened a lot. We've also had some games that mix it up and change things up. But we saw a lot of the teams that control the ball move into the next round of this competition. Italy being one of them. There's a bunch of other ones. Spain is moving through. Germany controls a lot of the ball. So we're seeing a lot of these big kind of classic juggernauts move through in that way. And we didn't really see any big teams go out in the early stages of this competition. That's kind of something that we expect in any big tournament. At least one big team doesn't make it through. But Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, England, Croatia, Spain, France, Germany, Portugal, all of the teams that maybe you'd expect to make it through out of this first round did.
And we're getting into that because the weird part, and I find this way even in World Cups too, it always seems that all the elite teams are on one half of the bracket and somebody else in the other half's like, hey, I get to go to a final and I don't have to go through the juggernauts of teams that the other side has to go through. But I think what I found interesting, Joe, is the Christian Eriksen situation, and I'm glad he's doing okay. And it was really scary to watch, and it's great to see Denmark in the round of 16, and they played hard this whole tournament. But I was wondering, because I hadn't had a chance to talk about it due to a dental issue I had. How do you think UEFA handled it? Because I was shocked they even threw out there an option for Denmark to forfeit that match.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this isn't a hot take. I don't think UEFA handled that particularly well at all, right? They come in and essentially they gave, from what we have been able to find out from Denmark and their FA and their coaching staff, it seems like that UEFA gave them two options. You can play the game later that day after Christian Eriksen had gone to the hospital, or you can play it tomorrow. And really those are two horrible options, right? We don't know the mental states of those players. Maybe some of them wanted to play and just get it over with, and maybe others of them really didn't want to and weren't ready to play that game at all, and maybe weren't ever going to be ready to play that game. It's an incredibly challenging situation. Yes, there's a tournament and there's a lot of money going into this, blah, 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 but that stuff ultimately is not as important as, first of all, the health of the players and Christian Eriksen specifically, but also the mental health and the well-being of the players and staff and on Denmark and also Finland in that game. That's a traumatic thing to have witnessed in the way that everything happened. It's an extremely difficult situation. So, I mean, yeah, we can look at UEFA's actions and certainly not give them a pass there.
So your biggest surprise from a team perspective so far has been what?
Oh, that's a phenomenal question. I think my biggest surprise, honestly, is teams that didn't perform at the level that I was thinking they were going to. Poland being a great example. They finished at the bottom of Group E. I thought this Poland team was going to finish. I certainly thought they were going to make it out of this group, probably top two in Group E alongside Spain. It was Sweden and Slovakia fighting for third and fourth. Poland has talent. They have maybe the best striker in this entire competition in Robert Lewandowski, who plays for Bayern Munich in Germany and just broke the goal-scoring record in the Bundesliga, that top division over in Germany. And he comes into this Poland team, and they have some talent as well. They have some talent surrounding him. Yes, they had an injury before this tournament to one of their key forwards as well, but they have the ability to come out and play some good soccer. And we really didn't see that for much of this tournament at all, frankly. We saw it in bits and pieces, but they finished with just 1 point from three games. That's disappointing. I think one team, though, that did impress me was the Netherlands. They have a coach that just recently took over, I believe, towards the end of 2020 in Frank de Boer, who's had a pretty unfortunate and poor coaching career at a club level so far, most recently coaching Atlanta United in Major League Soccer here in the United States and getting fired from that job and not doing a fantastic job with that group. And he falls upwards into that Netherlands job, takes over, and we're not really sure. Nobody's really sure how this team is going to play. Expectations are pretty negative. And they come out and win all three of their games in the group stage against Austria, Ukraine, and North Macedonia. And they look pretty good while doing it. They don't look perfect. They don't look flawless. And they still maybe aren't a tournament favorite at this point headed into the round of 16. But they looked like a team who could do some damage in this tournament. And that surprised me.
Could a surprise, I think, to me be slow starts by elite teams? And I think that's probably what made Italy's success in group play so interesting, even though their group wasn't as strong as other groups. They were dominant from the get-go. Meanwhile, you had Spain that needed time to find itself, or Slovakia just to get a goalie mistake to maybe spark them. And then you had Germany almost bowing out to Hungary when Hungary could have beat them. Is it surprising to see those powerhouses, when we'll get into their matches pretty soon, start slow, or is it just a product of you're playing this tournament right after a lot of them have finished their club seasons and people are just tired?
I think that is a part of it. I think physical and mental fatigue is a part of it. I also think, Ricky, it's just about the format of tournament soccer. And I kind of talked about – I was kind of getting at this with one of my big takeaways. A lot of teams passing the ball a lot and a lot of teams sitting deep. If you're a big team in this tournament, odds are – and it's maybe about 50-50, but there are a lot of these bigger nations with a lot of talent that try to just pass the ball through the other team, break into the box, and create scoring chances that way. Germany is certainly one of those teams. Spain is probably the best example of one of those teams. If you're a defensive team facing off against a Spain or against a Germany or against an Italy, you're going to sit deep. You're going to get as close to your goal as you can to try to compress that space and make life as difficult for that other team as possible. And so really that strategy, that approach, that hyper-defensive approach can be a real equalizer, can be a real leveler in a tournament like this. In the first game for Spain, they were up against Sweden, and Spain had 85% possession. Sweden had 15, and that's about as lopsided as you'll ever see in a game of soccer. That doesn't happen very often at all, and that was Sweden's approach to keeping Spain at bay, essentially. I believe that game ended in a 0-0 draw, and Spain had a lot of questions surrounding them after that game. Can they break through a team that defends in this low, compact block? And eventually they break through some of the other teams in their group, and they do make it out of the group. But I think it's mostly a product, these teams starting slow, is mostly a product of how other teams choose to game plan and actually execute that game plan against them.
So if we look at the knockout stage as of right now, and I think it's been really interesting. Let's look at the left side first, because I think the left side is where everybody's going to be like, how do you get out of this group? Or how do you get out of this spot to get into the final? You have Belgium, Portugal, Italy against Austria, France against Switzerland, and then Spain against Croatia. I told you only have to watch one of those four matches. You're only allowed to watch one. What are you picking?
Oh, man. I think I'm watching Belgium, Portugal. Not because I've been overwhelmingly impressed with Portugal. In fact, quite the opposite. I think they've been incredibly underwhelming so far in this tournament. And I don't know how they'll fare in this game. But boy, do they have talent to go toe-to-toe with Belgium, who also has an incredible amount of talent. Romelu Lukaku, Belgium's striker, their number nine, their forward, has been one of the best players in this entire tournament. He is just a phenomenal goal scorer, and he has been scoring goals. He's a handful for Portugal to deal with, but Portugal have big, talented center backs to deal with that. In Pepe and in Ruben Dias, in the middle of their back line, Portugal also has just an incredible amount of attacking talent that can be a real problem when they break out on the counterattack, when they're sitting deep and then running out and breaking into space. And Belgium likely are going to control most of the ball in that game. So that could fall into Portugal's hands, even though they've had a bit of a poor tournament so far. And then maybe Belgium will take that game by the scruff of the neck. I think that's two extremely talented teams going up against each other in a game that we would typically see in a quarterfinal or in a semifinal.
Yeah, this is a weird one because the loser of this match is going to feel like they were an absolute failure in their respective papers and their respective podcasts hosted by different people. It's a crazy match, and you just wonder, Ronaldo's had his time in Euros, obviously the defending champions being Portugal. How much pressure is on Belgium to actually have big results in tournaments? I know they made, I think it was the semifinals a few years ago, last year, but before that they were just known for beating Tim Howard and Team USA for the most part. So how much pressure is on guys like Hazard and De Bruyne and Lukaku to actually win this tournament? Is this their last shot at it?
I think there's just a lot of pressure on these guys. I've heard the idea of this being the last time around for this golden generation of talent for Belgium. It seems to me like that would be the 2022 World Cup. I mean, there's not a whole lot of time between this tournament and that tournament in the late fall or winter next year in 2022. So I don't know that this is that group's last go-round, but man, they have the talent. Belgium has the talent to make a run in this tournament, and anything short of maybe a semifinal appearance, maybe a spot in the finals, I think will be disappointing for Roberto Martinez, their coach, and this really talented group of players.
Looking at the bottom half of that left side, we talked about Spain's slow start. Let's talk about France, who is the defending World Cup champions. They look pretty good. I don't blame them for losing basically a road game in Hungary. I don't know how the organizers did that to France. I'm confused. But what have you made of this French side? And is getting through that group and winning the Euro group of death, so to speak, a blessing? Or do you think it could wear them down going into the knockout round?
I don't think it'll necessarily wear them down. I think they should actually be pretty pleased with their draw for this round of 16 against Switzerland. Switzerland are a capable team, but they certainly don't have the level of talent that France do. And I think because France tend to be one of the more conservative, talented teams in this tournament, along with Portugal, they have so many quality players that do big things in the Champions League and for their top clubs in Europe. But the way Didier Deschamps, French manager, has them playing, it's much more defensive, and they look to be the ones who absorb pressure and then break out in transition. I don't know if Switzerland have the talent and the ability in defensive transition to cope with France as they do break out into that space. So winning the group of death and ending up with this draw against Switzerland, I think actually sets them up quite well for a run in the latter stages of this whole thing.
Looking at the right side of the draw, you got matches such as Sweden against the Ukraine, Netherlands and the Czech Republic, Wales against Denmark, which I'll get into. But I think if I asked you to pick one on the right side, Joe, you probably would pick Germany, England, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be such an interesting game. I always love to dive into the tactics and how things are playing out on the field and digging a layer deeper. England and Germany is just such a fascinating matchup to me because both teams were a little bit underwhelming in the group stage. England is pretty conservative. Germany can be a little slow sometimes in how they attack, and I just think it's going to present so many interesting tactical, strategic battle and matchups between Yogi Löw, Germany's manager, and Gareth Southgate, England's manager. I think this is going to be a fascinating one to watch. In addition to all that, you have the super talented and really quality players on the field. That's going to be a good game, I think.
Yeah, because when I'm Germany, I'm kind of, again, I'm talking about you can't control this sometimes just the way it goes. Nobody else is at home for the round of 16, but England is. I would kind of be ticked off if I'm Germany essentially playing a road round of 16 match. But the question I have, like you said, with England, why, and I know they've talked about this on like some of the shows, why don't they go forward? Only two goals in this tournament and they're by Raheem Sterling, who everybody hated he was on the roster, and yet he's the one scoring.
I think the counter argument to that line of thinking is, wow, England have not given up any goals, and True. They've barely given up any shots in this tournament. I think there's a very valid and commonly used line of thinking for big international tournaments and just international soccer in general, and that is defending might be more important than attacking. If we can build a solid defensive foundation, then anything after that is just gravy. And so England have so far in their group, and they haven't been tested in the way that they will be against Germany, I don't think. So this could totally bust that theory for Gareth Southgate. But as far as I can tell from watching these games, it seems like England's approach is, yes, we're going to control the ball, but we're not going to be super aggressive with our passing. We're not going to make a ton of really vulnerable off-ball runs where we make a run and then we leave ourselves vulnerable after we make that run, and maybe we have a gap in our shape. They're going to stay very tight. They're going to stay compact. They're going to move as a unit, even with the ball, so that when they turn it over, they can just press right back and win it, and they have that solid foundation ready, and they can continue that fundamental defensive play that we've seen so far. Is it going to be effective against Germany? I don't know. Is it the best way to approach a tournament? I also don't know. But so far, it has proven to be a pretty valid approach, even if it's not an especially entertaining one.
This match will most likely happen after people hear this interview, but I'm so excited to watch Wales against Denmark. We mentioned the Denmark story, and Wales, one of the, has the better attacking players in the world than Gareth Bale, and they've been far in this tournament before. What do you expect will happen in this game?
I think Denmark will control a lot of the possession. I think they're going to take this game on, and they're going to be the protagonists, right? They're going to try to break through Wales. And that's not necessarily going to be an easy thing to do. Wales had Italy in the final group stage game. And yes, Italy had rotated a bunch of players because they were already through to the knockout round. So it was a different group of starters. But Robert Page, Wales manager, pulled out a really fascinating defensive approach to limit Italy. And he largely did. They gave up one goal and it was on a free kick. So not even from the run of play. It was from a set piece. So I think Wales have some defensive talent. But, man, I've just been so impressed with Denmark and the way that they've responded. No team should ever be put in a situation where they have to respond from, you know, a player collapsing on the field and the trauma that causes. But they were put in that position, and they have responded just incredibly well. They make it out in second place in this group, and they're rewarded with not an easy game against Wales, like I said, but compared to some of the other teams that they could have faced on that side of the bracket or just in this round of 16, I think you look at Wales and say, guys, we can do this. We can make the quarterfinals of this tournament after everything we've gone through. And that's just an incredible, incredible story.
Two other questions, at least on the European side. I think a surprising team could be Sweden. I was very impressed watching them play Poland in terms of they got up 2-0. It looked like they were going to be fine. Lewandowski scores twice. Place goes crazy. And then Sweden scores an extra time to win that group over Spain. Do you think they could be a surprise on this wide open right side if they win and they would play either England and Germany in the quarters?
Yeah, right. Sweden is the team that nobody wants to play in this tournament because of how they defend. They defend in a 4-4-2. They absorb a whole bunch of pressure. They make your life miserable as that attacking team. Ukraine is not going to enjoy facing them. And that game could go either way. But if Sweden make it out and they go on to face the winner of England, Germany, neither one of those teams is going to want to play Sweden either, right? Spain had trouble breaking them down. England, who I've already talked about, is this pretty conservative offensive team. England's likely going to have trouble breaking Sweden down and playing through that low defensive block. And Germany had similar troubles in the group of death, right? They played right through Portugal, but, I mean, Portugal defended very poorly in that game. They had some trouble breaking down France, and they had trouble breaking down Hungary. So if I'm Sweden, I'm saying, guys, this is our time too, right? Just like I talked about with Denmark, if we can make it past this first game, we can make it into the quarterfinals, maybe cause some problems. The exact same thing goes for Sweden, and it would not surprise me at all to see them sneak into the semifinals of this tournament.
So out of all these round of 16s, I'll throw you one more question on it. Which one or multiple ones will most likely come down to penalty kicks? Because I'm a big penalty kick guy.
I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah, I mean, and this is the first stage of the competition where we can see penalty kicks happen. So I think that could work out really well. I do think Belgium-Portugal could be an option for that. Two extremely high-profile teams with very contrasting styles, I guess. I think Belgium is not always this possession juggernaut, but I think they're going to have to be in this game, and they certainly have the ability to be. So I think that game could come down to the wire. I also think Sweden-Ukraine could be in a similar situation where Sweden just don't give up much defensively. Ukraine control a lot of the ball but don't have a ton of success breaking through. That game could see extra time, and that game could see penalties as well.
So we've got to talk about USA Soccer, which has not been a popular topic to talk about if you like good things to discuss. But they actually, a few weeks ago, beat Mexico in the Nations Cup. Fun match. Fans going a little too crazy. Christian Pulisic shines. How much do we take away from that? And is there good momentum for this team going into World Cup qualifying that have you actually watched USA in a World Cup this time?
Yeah, good momentum for sure coming out of this Nations League game. The U.S. still has a Gold Cup to play starting in July, but it's going to be a different group of players just to give a lot of the A-tier guys some time off because they've been playing a lot of games for their clubs, and playing through the entire summer is not healthy. So we're going to see a lot of rotation for the United States before World Cup qualifying starts in September. But yeah, I mean, I think it's in terms of takeaways from that 3-2 win over Mexico back earlier this month, momentum, it's got to be a big one, right? We saw this tier of players, this Christian Pulisic generation, this Weston McKennie, Gio Reyna, Tyler Adams coming off the bench in that game. We saw these guys get tested. And man, that just hadn't happened a whole lot so far under Greg Berhalter since 2019. There hadn't been a ton of games against teams as good as Mexico. There had been a competitive one back in 2019, but the generation of this young, talented generation was still not fully integrated into that group. And so we fast forward to 2021, and you have this final against Mexico, where Mexico has their best team out on the field and the U.S. has their best team out on the field. And the U.S. didn't dominate that game by any stretch of the imagination. They didn't. But they played well. They did a lot of things well in that game, and they didn't let Mexico run all over them, which has happened in the last couple of years. They absorbed pressure. They would try to adapt in how they played from maybe the way that Greg Berhalter typically sets them up. And they got the result in just an absolutely bonkers game to have the mentality. A lot of these things are intangible, right? And so I don't know exactly how much this will pay off in the future because I'm not a professional athlete. But they got the job done in a crazy game with a crazy atmosphere. The game went all the way into the second period of extra time, and there were still chaotic things happening even then. Players stepped up in big moments, and if that doesn't give you momentum for World Cup qualifying, the most important thing for this team outside of World Cup itself, that's a big takeaway.
So what is there a ceiling on this group, or is it still the bar is just really low that just get in and then go from there?
In terms of a spot at the World Cup, I mean, the expectation is that this group qualifies for the World Cup. There's no excuses for them not to qualify in back-to-back cycles. This cycle and this group is infinitely more talented than the last group that failed to qualify in Trinidad and Tobago. So the baseline expectation is that this group makes it to a World Cup. After that, I'm going to be honest, I don't know what the expectation is for this group. If they make it out of a group at the World Cup, that would be incredible. That right now, not knowing who the group would be and not knowing who they'd be up against, that wouldn't be my expectation for them to make it out of a group at the World Cup. But this is a building block. This is an opportunity for this group to compete at a higher stage than many of them have ever competed at before, get that experience. And then I think a lot of people are looking to 2026, and myself, I typically find myself included into that group. 2026 is when a lot of these players are going to be in their prime. So make it to the World Cup in 2022. Then once we see the group, we can figure out what expectations look like once we know who's actually going to that tournament, if they make it to that tournament at all. And then we can have a clearer idea of what the ceiling is or maybe what the floor should be for this group.
I think also when you look at the – it's probably a lot tougher, especially in this format, because from what I'm looking at real quick – correct me if I'm wrong, but if there's not like Euros where the third-place teams get in. I think if the third-place teams got in, then you could definitely say the U.S. should even make a knockout round because it's not too hard to be in third. If you have to come in runner-up and this – where they're not where they're supposed to be. I think they've at least preserved themselves. Hopefully no more Taylor Twellman rants on ESPN. But besides that, to me, it's just get to the World Cup and keep the popularity of the sport growing. Cause I don't know, as much as the sport's growing in the United States, I don't think they could afford to miss two World Cups in a row.
I mean, yeah, nobody wants that, right? It hurts the sport in this country. It doesn't, you know, incredibly impact that, but it certainly hurts the growth of soccer in the United States, and it hurts this program, it hurts these players, right? You want to see them competing. They want to be playing at that level. That's the goal for a lot of these guys, at least in terms of international soccer, is to go and play in a World Cup. And so there's no doubt in my mind that this group can do it and be very challenging to play against on a stage like that. But, I mean, they do have to make it first, and I'm excited for World Cup qualifying to start in September for us to see more meaningful games with this set of players.
So, Joe, tell listeners out there about the work you do at Total Soccer Show, anything else that you do and related to soccer, and how they can follow you on Twitter.
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter at Joe C. Lowry. I've been on the Total Soccer Show about every day. Today and yesterday were the first couple of days off because we've been doing daily shows recapping the Euros. We're going to continue that every day there's a game. We'll have a podcast about it. Myself and Taylor Rockwell, Ryan Bailey, and Graham Ruthven have been gathering around our microphones in our respective locations and talking about soccer. If you're interested in Major League Soccer, you can listen to MLS Assist, which is a podcast that myself and Jordan Angeli put out each week on Monday. We have a ton of fun breaking down the tactical side of Major League Soccer. And then, yeah, there's a couple other things, but following me on Twitter is probably the best way to get at all that stuff.
And be sure to follow Joe. Follow Total Soccer Show team. As I said before, I've listened to the show on and off, I think, since the Rio World Cup. And as somebody who's not a huge soccer fan, they do a good job of kind of giving you the tactical if you are one, and then also explaining it in a way where you can also still understand and you're not going crazy trying to look up. So I will say that it's a fun show, and you learn a lot on it. Joe, thanks again for hopping on. Keep up the great work. We'll be listening, and thanks for hopping on. I appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah, thanks again for having me.
Thanks to Joseph Lowry from the Total Soccer Show for hopping on and talking a little bit of Euro 2020 with us. I've been really happy to get a chance to do some soccer and try to do that as we get, maybe as the show gets further on and we maybe do World Cup next year. Definitely going to bring some guests on to talk about the sport a little bit more. Very quickly, we're going to wrap the show with a couple of minor sports, but still some big news this week. Wimbledon, back for the first time in 2 years. Remember, no Wimbledon last year due to COVID-19. Rafael Nadal not in the tournament for the men's side. Naomi Osaka not in the tournament for the women's side. Osaka, remember what happened with the French Open. I'm sure she's trying to get the help she needs and also focusing on the Olympics coming up next month. So big matches on Monday. At Wimbledon, Novak Djokovic, who has won the first two slams and the prohibitive favorite to win a third. I know Medvedev from Russia is playing well on grass. Dominic Thiem is not in Wimbledon. That's a guy who would be a threat to Djokovic. Tsitsipas, of course, would be in this tournament. Zverev, but are they really a threat? And Roger Federer, I think, would be the other guy. But as great as Federer is on grass, best grass court player of all time, hasn't played many matches. And I think that's something to monitor. But I think if the Wimbledon can get Djokovic against Federer, it'd be great. But Djokovic will play against a player from Great Britain to open the day. Sloane Stephens and Petra Kvitova is a fun first-round match. And Andy Murray back on center court, which I'm sure fans will appreciate. Tsitsipas actually gets Francis Tiafoe, the American, on Monday. That should be a fun matchup there. So that's your situation on the men's side. Djokovic, again, the number one seed. The number two seed is Medvedev. I'm trying to get to the list of seeds here. We'll break down this tournament more as it goes on. Zverev's the four, Tsitsipas is the three. I think I'd keep an eye on a guy like Taylor Fritz. If you're looking for an American to root for, John Isner, of course, has always played well on grass. Making a semifinal before Riley Opelka. We saw the American men play well at the French. We'll see how they do at Wimbledon. On the women's side, no Simona Halep either. No Naomi Osaka, so it opens up the draw a little bit for somebody like Serena Williams, who announced, I believe on Sunday, she's not playing the Olympics. That's big news. Number one seed on the women's side is Ash Barty. She has a tough match, though, with Carlos Suarez-Navarro playing in her last Wimbledon, so an emotional match for her, but Suarez-Navarro playing in the Olympics for Spain. Elena Ostapenko, I know, is playing well. Somebody to watch. Bianca Andreescu is back, reigning former U.S. Open champion. Svitolina, the three seed, is always tough. But a potential, I think, if you're an American tennis fan, potential fourth-round match in the round of 16 between Serena and Coco Gauff, which I think people would kind of like the passing of the torch, in a sense, if that match were to happen. So Wimbledon's always fun. I love watching. It's my second favorite slam besides the U.S. Open. It's great. It'd be great to see the All England Club. I know it's not – I think it's half capacity, but – it'll still be really cool to finally see Wimbledon again. Now, we're going to wrap it up with a little College World Series, and the final is set, Vanderbilt against Mississippi State. It should be, from an on-field perspective, it should be a fun series, best of three. Because you got Vanderbilt with their rotation of Kumar Rocker and Jack Leiter, who are going to be top 10 picks in the draft in a few weeks, and Mississippi State, who has a great pitcher that you want to watch in Will Bednar, who probably won't get the pitch in the series unless it's game three, but he had 15 strikeouts in six innings earlier in the week against Texas. So Bednar is a good player. But you have a little bit of controversy, not controversy, but it's some sad news that happened. NC State, who was the fun underdog of the tournament, remember, they beat the top seed Arkansas in the Super Regionals to get to the College World Series. They beat Stanford. They beat Vanderbilt 1-0 in a game where Jack Leiter struck out, I think it was 14. So NC State was set to play Vanderbilt on Friday, and all NC State had to do was beat Rocker or Leiter once in two games, and they would go to the final. Comes out Friday, there is a delay because NC State had two players test positive were out due to COVID issues. Second baseman JT Jarrett and reliever Evan Justice. Now, because those two players tested positive, they had to test the whole team. Because, yes, most of the team was vaccinated, but that's the rules that the NCAA had set under the protocols. Now, you could argue, remember, it's full capacity in Omaha, so there's you're doing these tests and things like that. You got full capacity in these buildings. It's a different story. So NC State, they elect to play the game. Now, they played Vanderbilt Friday with 13 eligible players, 9 position players, which is your starting lineup, and 4 pitchers. Almost won the game. They had the winning run at the plate. They lost 3-1. So give the Wolfpack credit. I mean, you're playing a pitcher at first base, and you're still finding a way to get the job done, or at least try to compete, because nobody expected them to win. So you wait throughout the day, and then at 2 a.m. Saturday night, remember, the Texas-Mississippi State game was in a delay, so you had to wait till 2 a.m. to find out if there was going to be a game three on, or game two on Saturday night between Texas-Mississippi State. Mississippi State won a walk-off last night. But it comes out, NC State's rule the no contest, which we've seen in different NCAA events, VCU in the tournament, for example, in basketball, that NC State was no longer going to be allowed to play. The athletic director, Boo Corrigan, said, "The last 24 hours have been extremely difficult for everyone involved, and my heart goes out to the student-athletes, coaches, and staff of our baseball program. The health and safety of our student-athletes and staff will always be our unwavering priority. The timing of this is simply devastating for everyone involved. It doesn't diminish their incredible accomplishments this season." Now, let me say this. I don't think Vanderbilt needs to apologize, like people are saying, or tell the NCAA we're not playing until NC State's eligible. First off, these things have rules. These games have to get played. Remember, the athletic year, I think, ends in beginning of July. You also have players in these tournaments that are going to get drafted, and this year it's a little different because the College World Series is before the draft. So I will not ever ask a team to apologize for advancing on into a championship. These are the rules that were set, and that's where we're at. I think the NCAA has its issues here, but they're not the only ones at fault. And I don't blame the NC State coaching staff per se. I know we had the press conference on Friday that said he's not going to address it except at the College World Series talk, like on-field baseball, which you'd expect. But you had two players we're not going to get into this, but the whole two players not vaccinated, and you wonder, like we've seen in these sports, where if you get to 85% vaccination rate, your restrictions get lifted. And you had two players test positive that, I mean, you got to read between the lines a little bit in this situation. It's not an easy thing to talk about. It's obviously with the political climate that we're in, where all of a sudden, where we talked about over the last year, how vaccines and mask wearing and things have become political when they really shouldn't be. And it's just a sad way for your season to end. You feel for NC State. They had a fantastic season. Do I think the NCAA could have did a better job? Could I think they maybe waited and played the two games Saturday? Maybe. But again, you don't know what would happen with testing. You had players that couldn't play with the could players that weren't testing positive have had a chance to play, where you could have at least fielded someone on a competitive team? Because it's a bad look for the NCAA to have them play the game Friday. And you, as long as you have those same 13 players, why wouldn't you play the game Saturday? And give those kids an opportunity where one win gets them in to the championship. Now, the doomsday scenario for the NCAA was avoided. If NC State had won that game Friday, the championships, there would be no championship series. Essentially, Texas and Mississippi State would have played Saturday night for the championship. And if Mississippi State had beaten Texas in the rain delay game on Friday, they would have got the trophy wheeled out at 2:30 a.m., admittingly from the coaching staff, without knowing they would have won the title. Think about how sad that would have been. Like, all of a sudden you're like, oh yeah, we won. Like, you don't get to kind of fully grasp that situation. But this is what playing sports in a pandemic looks like. It is, you've seen some tournaments go off without hitches. We've seen some like this where a team that is a chance to win a College World Series gets it taken away, and it's sad. I'm not going to use this to kind of blame anybody necessarily, because I don't really know who to put the full blame on or who to put the majority of the blame on, but I'm by no means, and I'm fully confident in saying this, by no means Vanderbilt should apologize. They did nothing here. They're just the beneficiary of what happened. Doesn't mean they're not talented. Vanderbilt's a really talented baseball team. They're defending College World Series champions. They're always really good. But besides that, it should be a fun College World Series to watch. So that final Monday night, 7 o'clock, ESPN2. Monday, Tuesday, potentially Wednesday. But Vanderbilt has the edge because they have Rocker and Leiter lined up, and Will Bednar from Mississippi State had to be used against Texas, so that's why those three aren't lined up. Want to remind you can follow me on Twitter, @RickNader555. Follow us on Twitter, @FP_coverage, @FullPressRadio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You reach your podcast, just search Kicking with Keeler. Please leave a rating. I want to hear from you, what you like, you don't like. You can email me, rickjkeeler@gmail.com. I am happy to hear from you. Also, want to remind you can check out my work at Pinstripe Prospects. We do From the Backfield to the Bronx every Thursday. We have beat writers from all four Yankee affiliates putting up great work as usual. MLB draft coming up, so stay tuned for that. You can check my work over at Barrett Sports Media. Did a couple articles this week, including a really good interview Troy Aikman did with Peter Schrager and Sean McVay about how he feels that broadcasters aren't the media when it comes to production meetings. I thought that was really a fun topic to get into. My special thanks again to Jared Book from Eyes on the Prize to talk about the Canadians and Joseph Lyer from the Total Soccer Show. I thought we had two really good guests this week. Next week, I'm going to try to get you a guest to preview the NBA Finals. We're going to get into baseball and preview the All-Star selections, Stanley Cup in full swing, Wimbledon in full swing, Euros in the quarterfinals. Maybe look at the hot dog eating contest a little bit. But sports are back, and they're in full swing. And it's been a lot of fun to talk about as we end the month of June on a good note. So from all of us here, Kicking with Keeler, I'm Ricky Keeler. Well, as a full press coverage saying, thanks for kicking with me, Ricky Keeler, on a Sunday. I'll see you back next week on 4th of July weekend. Enjoy your week, everybody.